Hi, this is Nick Palizzi from The Sacred Science, and I'm here tonight with a very special guest, Daniel Vitalis, wild food nutritionist and owner of SirThrival.com. This is an exclusive special event interview that you won't find anywhere else, not on YouTube, not on iTunes. This is for you, The Sacred Science, free online screening community only. So Daniel, I've been following your work for a long time, and it seems like you draw your influence from a bunch of different disciplines and cultures. Can you tell us how you've distilled these into your own approach?
I have, like, as a personality type, I'm somebody who jumps around through a lot of things. So I don't have this, like, and I worked 14 years with the Shipibo people. More what I do is I kind of pop in and out of a lot of different things. And I've had the opportunity to do, as an example, plant ceremonies with lots of different indigenous people, from people in the southwest of the United States to people in the jungle of Peru. I've had exposure to a lot of stuff. But primarily what interests me is this, that the thing is that we're all really shaped, of course, by our cultural paradigm, particularly by the paradigm of our language, right? So English is a language. It's very difficult for an English-speaking person to even understand indigenous cultures because their language is so incredibly different that it creates a different worldview. So English, because of the way it uses the verb to be, we tend to label everything and exploit everything. It's a language of commerce, essentially. So it leads to this exploitive kind of paradigm where we see an herb as an example as something we can exploit for something that's in it because we speak that way. So I've noted this. Most of the indigenous people on the planet today have all but lost their culture due to conquest and are very quickly being assimilated into our culture. What I don't think makes sense is for us as English-speaking people, modern Americans, let's say, modern Canadians, modern Europeans, to try to start doing these old rituals, right? They're great for us to do and be exposed to, but most of us don't benefit long term from just walking out the, you know, the old sweat lodge ceremony verbatim, because it doesn't make sense. It's not set up for our operating system, right? We have a different operating system. We're like PC, they're like Mac, and the software's not super compatible. So what I think makes sense is for us to draw upon those as we create a new culture. I like this idea. My friend Arthur Haynes and I coined this term for modern human beings who are partaking in some of the old ways we call ourselves Homo sapien neo-aboriginalis. And the idea is we are a subspecies of human beings today. My opinion is this. The indigenous people, hunter-gatherers, are Homo sapiens sapien, the true Homo sapiens sapien, that they are the wild form. The hunter-gatherer people are the wild form of humans. We are a domesticated form, the current sort of human dominating the planet. And I like to differentiate us as Homo sapiens domestico fragilis, a subspecies of fragile, domesticated, kind of sick human beings, ultra domesticated. And the idea is we can't go back to being Homo sapien in the same way that a modern dog can't go back to being a wild wolf, even though they are technically the same species. The subspecies of domesticated mini dachshund, for example, can't just backbreed itself to a wolf. We can't become indigenous Homo sapien again in the traditional form we think of. So we can become this new thing, neo-aboriginalis. And in that way, I guess coming around to your question is, I think what we have to do is create new ritual pathways for ourselves based on how we see the world, how we interact with the world, and what we understand about the world. And we have a lot of potential there, but I don't think it makes sense to practice, you know, word for word, the things that were done in cultures that no longer exist, in places and ecosystems and landscapes that are no longer present, with fauna and flora that are all but gone. I mean, though, sadly, we can't do that. That world's gone. What we have now is this world where people can again begin to experience these things. And what I think is really powerful and important here is that the practice of working with plants can open you up to some subtleties that allow you to understand them in the same way that indigenous people did. Now, they had a lot more time and they had a lot less stimulus, so their worldview probably developed in a way that's really different than ours will, but we can begin to reimmerse ourselves and actually become the new Aboriginal person. So I think that's where our potential is, really, more than, you know, and there are people, I meet people who go, like, for instance, you know, in Peru, I met people who, Europeans who had gone and spent the last 20 years living in the rainforest. I'm sure you've met similar folks. And I think in your film, I saw a similar person who had done that. But that's a rare individual. That's not practical on a large scale for most of us, you know. So we're headed forward. I think we need that forward escape rather than that sort of path backward.
I love that. I love that explanation. I mean, a lot of people want to pretty much adopt these cultures and sort of become these cultures. And, you know, I just got back from a really cool council in northern Wisconsin with a bunch of different tribes. And it was amazing to see them in their own element. But I felt like, you know, I respect this, but I don't know if I could ever really, in my full integrity, try to become what you guys are. You have an amazing beauty in and of yourself. I can learn from you. I can get some, just make some distinctions about my own life and how I want to sort of incorporate some of these practices into my life. But the idea of trying to adopt a culture like you're adopting a religion, like, oh, I'm now Buddhist. You know what I mean? It's like, it's just, it almost feels, there's something wrong. There's something that just feels off energetically about that. And I'm excited that you felt that you share that, because I've never heard anybody else speak about that before.
Yeah, well, we're really programmed too. I mean, we literally can't run their software programs effectively in our hardware because it's not set up for it. So we can't, and we shouldn't expect ourselves to. There's no way. I haven't found a purge or a reset button anywhere on me, right? Like, and I've really searched for that. Like, how do I reset myself back to natural human? You just can't. It's like I said. It's like we are the equivalent of that miniature dachshund who knows in its heart that it's a wolf. But its body is no longer a wolf's body. It can't even eat what the wolf eats. It can't hunt like the wolf hunts. Now, what it has to do is instead take stock of itself and say, okay, from here, where can I go? What's helpful about, I think, in looking at indigenous peoples, what they eat, how they live, it's very similar to if you find yourself lost in the woods, right? You find yourself lost in the woods. There's a panic moment. Oh my God, like I'm lost. You want to run around and freak out. That's what happens when we kind of wake up to how domesticated we are in our culture, how sick we are. It's like, oh my God, right? And we want to run and we want to try everything and do everything. The thing that really is valuable when you're lost is to sit down, stop for a second, and then ask yourself what your last known location was, right? What was the last place you knew where you were? And can you get back there? The indigenous people show us the last known location of health for human beings. Psychologically, physically, right? Emotionally, spiritually. The last place we know that we were really healthy is actually when we lived as hunter-gatherers. Because we see in our fossil record, I think this is so fascinating, the evidence shows us that as soon as we left the natural way of living, basically as hunter-gatherer limited gardeners, as soon as we left that, we started to get sick. We started to get disease. We start to see disease in our bones from the labor and work of forcing nature to produce in an agricultural way. We that was where we stepped off our path and we got lost. And we've been lost for 10,000 years. So looking at those people, go, that's like last known location. And if we start there, and from that place of knowing, okay, we're healthy when we hunt and we gather and we actually create a healthy environment. From there, we can start to go, okay, based, how do we build a lifestyle based on that idea? Even if it's going to be modern, even if it's going to have iPhones in it, how do we build it off of that? Because what we're doing now is we're building our whole the whole model for humans today, healthcare model, our dietary model, our food production model, is based more on Star Trek than it is based on what we know works on planet Earth, right? So it starts from this grandiose idea like we're space traveling alien angels and we can just do everything technologically, when what we see, the result of that, is the destruction of everything good and sacred. It doesn't work, even though it's glitzy and cool sounding. What actually worked was people living in harmony with nature, as of course you know. And so I think we really need to use that as a model. So I think of it as last known location, not necessarily a place that I'm going to get back to, just like I know the dachshund's not going to become a wolf again. But who knows what the dachshund can become if it slowly, generationally starts to incorporate its old practices again. Maybe it doesn't become the wild wolf. Maybe it becomes something new and different and really worthy of expression.
I mean, I have to imagine that in some way, shape, or form, the dachshund must have some advantage over the wolf. I mean, there has to be things that the dachshund has learned over the last 10,000 years, even if it was not quite as natural. I mean, there has to be some sort of evolution of the brain, right? I mean, is there anything that you could sort of speak to that might have actually helped us that the wolf didn't have that we might have gained in the last 10,000 years?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty obvious what we've gained, right? Our ability to communicate, our ability to understand the world. Well, you know what? It's really interesting. I don't know. It's like, wow, through the internet, we realize like we're all really one planet. It's like, well, okay, well, now I guess the indigenous people already really knew that. Well, you know, now we understand like that we can communicate through the power of light, right? Like the internet is like light speed communication, literally electromagnetism. But then we see in their worldview, they understood already that their body mind did that. So it's funny in that way. But I think that we have learned a lot of really amazing things scientifically that we don't have to give up, right? We can incorporate in. I think it's going to be a merger and a synthesis. But moving forward, I think one of the most important things that we really need to understand, and it is filtering in, of course it's filtering in now, this idea that every plant is a living organism. And if we get outside of calling them plants and we instead say we call them creatures instead, that kind of changes the flavor, right? Like that dandelion in your backyard is a creature, or how about this? It's a being. That one always really changes the game. So it goes from being something you grind up and put in a pill to being a being, a living thing. If it's a living thing, then it can be interacted with. Maybe not with English language, right? Maybe you can't hire it and give it a job and put it in a cubicle, but it's a living thing. And when you consume it, you're interacting with it, right? And you are, there's actually a relationship that's formed. So I think it's that, you know, for instance, in America today, the average person doesn't realize they have a relationship to corn, let's say. Even though they're almost completely made from it, even though it's in their gas tanks, even though everything in the house is touched by it or paid for by it. I mean, we have more of a relationship with corn than the Mesoamericans had with corn, really, even though they, you know, created it. And yet we don't know that, and we don't think of it like that. And our food is so changed by the time we see it that we often forget that this is a living being, right? Your plate is the bodies of living things, plant or animal, fungi or bacterial. And we just lose that. And indigenous people, they were so close to the bone in that sense that there was this understanding that they were enmeshed in a web of life and that everything needed everything else. But we're isolated from that. And we're moving into this era. Maybe you've seen it now. I've just been really blown away here we are in 2013, by this idea of 3D printed food. And so if you haven't seen it, what it is they're taking a few genetically modified organisms, and then they're breaking them down into a printable format and putting them in cartridges, and then they're 3D rendering food items. So these highly processed, interesting shaped foods that can only be made through printing. So you get this thing that now no longer resembles an organism at all, right? So if you have a piece of broccoli on your plate, you can look at it and say, okay, that's the floret, right? That's the unopened flower portion of a Brassica oleracea plant. But if you get a 3D printed food, it's kind of like when you get a Twinkie. How do you tell what a Twinkie is, right? So here's this processed food that's made out of genetically modified algae, crickets, you know, lichen seed, lupin seeds, and mealyworms. And it can be colored to anything. It can be made to taste like anything. And we are headed towards that Star Trek world where a person wouldn't even really know that what they eat is the cells and bodies of another organism. That's taken us really far off course, because we forget that if you destroy the ecosystem, there's no food. Food has to come from an ecosystem. So I think that's one of the biggest things we're going to have to reintroduce in the resurgence and renaissance in farming and local agriculture and at-home gardening is helping, because people are starting to understand, wow, okay, this is actually – food is something that's produced by a biome, not from a store. But most people don't get to see that.
Going back to the language, I mean, this seems a lot to do with languaging. Like, you know, the way that we've started to language our reality has taken us, probably been very, has contributed very much to how far we've gone off course, right? But how did that languaging start to shift? And how did our relationship to our environment start to shift? Some people think that it's, you know, women being disempowered. And I kind of tend to agree that maybe, you know, at the same time that you see disease start happening in our history, you also start seeing actually the development of written language and, you know, maybe an emphasis taken off of women as being this divine, you know, this divine presence and more of like reeling in nature and trying to wrestle nature down and make it a little bit less mysterious and unpredictable. What I'm asking you is, where do we go off course and what's your opinion about how we can get back on?
Well, you know, you're touching on a true mystery. This is no one knows, actually, the answer to this. So here's what we do know collectively, right? We see that somewhere around 6,000 years ago, out of literally from what's known. Now, who knows if there are societies who keep this information and maybe it's not available to us. But what we know collectively, what's out there, is out of nowhere emerges a civilization, Sumeria, out of nowhere. Now, it doesn't emerge like loincloths and like people with furrowed brows, like beating, you know, on animals with clubs. All of a sudden, out of nowhere, there's written language, cuneiform, right? There's all of the stone cuneiform tablets recording history. There's cuneiform tablets describing the outer solar system of that we're a part of, right? Describing planets and what an approach in looks like. This is fascinating. Clothing is developed, language is developed, city states are developed, finance, economy, money is developed. All of a sudden, spontaneously out of nowhere, not a long, slow evolutionary curve like Darwinism would predict, but rather there's an explosion and suddenly there's culture. Now, it's associated with a phenomena called the Neolithic Revolution. And the Neolithic or the New Stone Age Revolution is the planting of crops and the rearing of animals, right? So I can't speak fully on language because I don't know fully what the origin is, but I'll say this. I can speak because I have a lot of expertise on the subject of domestication. And what we see is that domestication just sprang up apparently out of nowhere, and it happened in a few places. It happened in Peru, it happened in China, and it happened in Mesopotamia. Now, Mesopotamia, it appears to have happened the earliest, so let's focus there. And I don't want to discriminate against China and Peru, but we know more about what happened in Mesopotamia. People started planting wheat. Now, there's this modern kind of paleo idea that we shouldn't eat grains, and it's not natural for us, and hunter-gatherers don't eat grains. That's just completely made up. Hunter-gatherers do eat grains, but they would forage those grains, and grains are the seeds of grasses. Now, what happened was people started to plant those. Now, there's this idea in the Darwinian kind of science, like one day somebody like, seed, like plant. Like, people knew that plants came from seeds, obviously, right? They lived immersed in the environment. You don't go down to the Amazon and find a very untouched people and surprise them with the knowledge that plants come from seeds, right? They get that. That doesn't mean, though, that you immediately decide to exploit that. Because in order to plant grains, what you're really going to have to do is create an artificial disaster in an ecosystem. So what you'll do is tear up the earth, put these seeds in there, and they'll spring up, right? And that's, and eventually what you end up having to do is tend to that. I mean, it's a grass seed, so you've got like a lawn, and that requires a lot of work. It wasn't well understood. Why would people even do that? Because it was way more work to grow things than it is to forage and hunt things. So hunter-gatherers put in less than 20 hours a week of work. Farmers work sun up till sundown, and their bones ache at the end of the day. Why would we do that? So there's some good evidence now that we actually did it because you could produce alcohol from the seeds, right? So the seed mash became a kind of beer, and the desire to consistently have that kind of alcohol. Now, other hunter-gatherer peoples, they figured out alcohol too, but they'd only have it when the certain fruit that they made it from would come around. So we see in like the desert southwest of the United States, for instance, the saguaro cactus fruit season is associated with a huge wine drinking ritual, but then the wine's all drunk up and it's gone, and then they got to wait till the next year. Well, the production of grains allowed the production of beer and the production of bread. It also allowed for, and this is going to answer your question, I know it's really roundabout, but it produced surpluses of food. Now, prior to that, one of the things we see with hunter-gatherers in average is that even the chief hunts and gathers. He doesn't have the opportunity to sit back and be the king and everybody brings him everything, because there was no surplus. Hunting and gathering doesn't produce a lot of surplus. So you can't get like a year's worth of, you know, 3 years worth of food in one season. You get a year's worth of food in one season, and then you have to keep gathering and keep hunting, right? When you do agriculture, you do way more work, but you can produce surplus. Once there was surplus, there was somebody to govern the surplus. Once there was somebody to govern the surplus, that person needed a priesthood to convince people to continue to produce surpluses for him. Once you have that in place, you need a aggressive and defensive class of to police over all of this, and you need to start creating rules and hierarchical structure. Once you have that, you need to enforce a peasant class of slave labor in order to continue to produce all this stuff, because it's not natural to us to do this. So agriculture is not this like wonderful shift that happened. It actually created a lot of disease in our body, and it created hierarchical male-governed structures like you're talking about. And it's led to this exploitive world. See, if President Obama had to go out and actually work the land for his food too. It'd be a very different world, right? But he's in a different position. It's a pyramid-like hierarchical structure to the person at the top. Now that emerges spontaneously in Mesopotamia 6 to 10,000 years ago. Also happened in Peru and China. And so they ended up with similar things. And what they started to do was change organisms, right? So you take an organism like wheat and you change it. Over time, you domesticate it into something that's not really recognizable in its natural form anymore, something that can't survive in nature anymore. And you do it with animals too. So it starts with our sheep, goats, pigs, cows, and we end up in the situation where we are today, where the whole planet's dependent on a very small suite of hyper-mutated domesticated organisms, and we destroy more and more of the earth to create the artificial habitat that those organisms live in. Because those organisms are not adapted to the earth, they're adapted to man-made contained farms and gardens, which are artificial disasters that we create, and that keeps spreading out and spreading out and spreading out, and all of the surpluses keep funneling up to the top. And what it ends up with is an elite at the top who don't want to release and relinquish that power, no matter how bad the situation is for the peasants or the planet. And so all of it's all tied together. Language, finance, policing, kings and queens, royalty, elites, it all ties into this thing that happened where human beings stepped off the path. Unlike the squirrel, right? You have the squirrel who simply goes out and gathers its nuts and it makes its home and everything is done from the wild. We are the squirrel that took the nut, created an artificial place, buried it, let it grow up, controlled that, fought over that. And we've ended up in this situation where we are today. It all started with the Neolithic Revolution in farming. So it was going from being a hunter-gatherer to being an agriculturalist. And unfortunately, now we're in this tough spot where we can't just jump back to hunting and gathering. We've destroyed too much environment and there's too many people. So now we've got to move forward in this, like, to this limited kind of horticultural husbandry thing. But we've got to decentralize all of this agriculture, or, I mean, it's not sustainable. And I guess I'll close this rant with this piece. Sumeria came up, like I said, out of nowhere, and then they just die back. They're just gone. And a few other cultures in that area sprung up, and then they're gone. And Babylon springs up, and it's gone. And Egypt springs up, and it's gone. And then the Greek Empire, and then it collapses, and the Roman Empire, and it collapses. And what it's been is a domino effect. Cultures, they follow a sine wave. Cultures rise up to their golden age, and then they collapse. We would be foolish to not recognize that we are over the crescendo in our culture, and we are headed in. We display the signs. A great book, Jared Diamond's book, Collapse, shows all these ways in which we are also headed towards a kind of collapse. Now, there's the possibility that we can avert it, but it's worth noting we would be the only example where that's ever happened. So we don't have examples of a culture that's been perpetual. Of course, culture sells the story that it's perpetual because it's in its own interest. It's like a machine, and it's like self-preservation as its goal. But we don't know any examples of this actually ever being sustainable. So we see that human beings living outside of hunting and gathering, with some exceptions of limited gardening, are not sustainable. And we may not be, or we may come up with something new.
It seems that even though it does tend to end badly, it seems like a rational method it seems rational that we would try for it. It seems like after a certain period of time, you're sick of seeing, you know, two of your family members die of starvation or because there's a drought or because there's there's not enough fish in the lake that year. You know, your family is starving and they're not healthy. It seems like it's a rational decision for people to try to sort of wrestle nature to the ground, even though it never works.
Interestingly, though, so I would like to point this out. Famines only affect agriculturalists, not hunter-gatherers. Starvation on a large scale from lack of food is actually a problem for agriculturalists. So what happens is agriculturalists develop, let's say, these fields. But those fields are – see, you notice how when you wild forage, let's keep it super simple. Like we're going to go wild forage literally dandelion roots, right? We don't have to water dandelions. We don't have to till soil for dandelions. And we don't worry like, wow, it's been a really dry summer. The dandelions aren't doing well. They just do well, right? Because they're so wild and so adapted. Now, the thing is if we want to grow something in our garden, we need to water it or we need to have lots of rains, right? You're reliant on, say, things like in Egypt, reliant on the flooding of the Nile to bring silt, minerals, and water up onto the banks where you're growing your food, right? And if something goes wrong in that equation, everybody, you've built up a city state reliant on that. Now everyone suffers and has to live off surpluses gained in the past. Whereas hunting and gathering, there's always alternatives to stuff. So we actually don't see that. Now the thing is so there's a myth, right? We have, because here's one of the biggest problems, and I know you're going to get this. It's like, this is so obvious, but wasn't obvious to me as a kid. When I, if, and this will help be helpful for the listener if any of this information seems new. There's a tendency when you say indigenous people to picture the kids on those just give 10 cents a day commercials with like bloated bellies and flies on their faces. Right? It's like those like little, you know, poor brown kids in diapers with the bloated bellies. It's like those are indigenous people who've experienced conquest, had all their greatest males taken out of the gene pool, had all their women like raped by conquistadors, then got pushed onto some reservation land while their best lands were stolen for agriculture or mining or forestry. And today they live in squalor, trying to survive off the rations they get from the UN. And we see those people and we think, oh, we're so lucky to live how we live. When actually we live how we live off their stuff. Right? That's why they live like that. So when I say indigenous people, I want you to picture like the Native Americans in, you know, Dances with Wolves with their full regalia and perfect health and beautiful stature, well-formed teeth, no disease, beautiful skin, shining and glowing. This was what was actually taking place all over the planet. Now we see them and we think, oh, wow, I mean, those conditions must have been harsh. I can see why you'd want to move indoors. We actually have a really twisted perspective on that. And the thing is that we don't have a lot of places we can go look and see. You know, we can see this on Bushman today wearing Reeboks on a National Geographic video in a Nike t-shirt and go like, yeah, it doesn't look that good for them. We're not seeing them at the height of. Now, what's interesting though is that one of the things I've noted about in my studies of indigenous peoples is that they don't have a progress-based paradigm. So it can be confusing, like nothing really changes that dramatically over time. They just keep doing things the way that works. We have a hard time with that because, see, we struggle to not to understand why you wouldn't improve things and tomorrow improve them again and tomorrow improve them again and tomorrow improve them again. Till we end up with this to the point where rather than having like one kind of really efficient vehicle that everyone uses, we have 400 options and every 6 months a new one comes out and you constantly have to get rid of the old one and get the new one because progress at any cost. We keep growing at any cost. Infinite growth paradigm, it's called. And we know it's not sustainable. We can't grow forever like that off a limited finite resource. So the indigenous people, it's hard for us to understand, like, not having constant progress built into the system. It sounds boring to us or something like that because that's what we use as stimulation. Whereas for them, there was way more community, there was way more connection, there was way more ritual, there was more of a sense of connectedness to the ecosystem. Lives were fulfilled with other things that are missing in our lives, which we try to fill with infinite growth and never really works. And we all know that. And that's why the richest people in the world are all on, you know, antidepressant drugs trying to figure out what the meaning of their life is. So it's funny. So here we are picturing these people that we've created as being what we come from when we actually don't come from that, then we feel bad for them and think we're really lucky even though we're using their stuff. It's just this, it's really sick and we've been miseducated. There's no, the system itself at large as its own almost organism has no interest in us learning correctly because it would self-destruct. So it needs us to learn a myth, the myth that we are apes becoming angels. Yeah, it's a myth.
You know, when you were saying there was no real need to advance technologically, I kind of feel like they probably place a lot more of importance on spiritual advancement and evolving as a spiritual being and as a person, as opposed to growing your teepee into a teepee with a 4-car garage on it. Whereas we're so spiritually detached and detached from our surroundings and our communities that the only way we can even think right now to evolve is by bursting out, materialistically, and having, more things and more stuff to kind of show everybody else in this very competitive society that we're at the very top, as opposed to these guys who are, like you said, the Chiefs were out gathering with everybody else. But I think that there was a respect for how deep they were and how old their soul was, as opposed to where we are now.
You become chief based on people's belief that you mature and you made good decisions. And I want to be clear here. There's this whole idea, the myth of the noble savage. Like, I love the word savage because it means wild in French. Sauvage is a French word for wild. And I think it's so interesting when you think from the domestication versus wild kind of paradigm understanding that it was understood that those were wild people and that we were different somehow from wild people because we were domesticated people. So making the distinction of the savage versus the civilized person is really interesting, because civilized comes from the word civil, which is a reference to living in cities. And remember that indigenous people never build cities, because what cities are a product of civilizations who are agriculturalists. So what happens is they produce the city state where all the food from the farms gets funneled in and all the resources get funneled in, and that doesn't work in an indigenous culture. We in civilization, now we're at a place where we tend to romanticize them a little bit, some of us, and there's this idea of the myth of the noble savage. I don't mean to imply that these are utopian cultures. I know it's not, like the movie Avatar, where it's just this like perfect, wonderful, there were hardships, no question. Just like the wild wolf deals with certain hardships in its environment. However, it doesn't deal with hip dysplasia like its domesticated cousin does, right? So they had I don't mean to say that their lives were perfect, but I think that they had things that how do we really vet it? How do we separate the wheat from the chaff here? Here's how. For 200,000 years from the first human in a modern form until 10,000 years ago, perfect development, perfect childbirth, perfect lifespan, no cavities, no bone deformities, no, it just works. Then an experiment starts 10,000 years ago and it tanks right off the bat. So I'm not saying they were perfect, but their thing worked for 200,000 years. So we got to look at it and say, well, that clearly makes more sense than what we're doing. Our thing has never worked. Right from the beginning of agriculture, we see holes in the teeth and the dental record. We see bone diseases immediately start forming. And we are at this point now where people can't even make it past 35 without some degenerative disease like diabetes, obesity, heart disease, cancer. It's crazy. We're that sick, right? Domestical fragilist. So anyway, looking back at them, we see, like you said, I think too, like a focus on like the understanding that your birth to your death was your personal journey, and then you go through developmental stages of learning for the cultivation of wisdom, and then you give back what you can to support your community and your people and your tribe. And our focus is all externalized. So we end up with it's so funny. I love that kind of cliche analogy of like you're looking in a mirror, you don't like the reflection, so you try to change the mirror rather than the thing that's reflected in the mirror, right? So we are all working on the mirror itself, literally trying to change reality. And you know what? Let's get really real here. It's like if people are hearing that and going, yeah, like that's kind of true, like it's real true, because here's what we're doing. Genetic modification. So we're hijacking organisms' DNA and splicing it together to create designer organisms that are patented and owned by companies. In other words, a slave species. Really, right? Like a company owns a species and they own the rights to that species' life. Nanotechnology. So we take the true building blocks of reality and we form new matter that is customizable, right? Like as if we have a really good track record with our technologies, right? Like this is now we're getting into some pretty heady stuff here. Leaving the planet and terraforming. These new technologies that are underway to literally take us off of our planet, which we haven't even figured out how to live on here, and go to other planets where we literally manipulate life and matter. These are really heady, heady things. Like That's that paradigm versus the paradigm of everything in nature is really perfect and we just have to learn how to live in harmony with it. Instead, we literally want to be gods of reality. And I think our track record shows we're not fit for it yet. And so we are like Mickey Mouse in Fantasia. He gets a hold of Merlin's hat and now has the ability to create magic, but he doesn't know how yet. He doesn't have the maturity of Merlin, right? Merlin has learned over the, he's an elder. Mickey's this young buck. He's got the magic hat. And in the movie, he creates chaos and disorder. And every time he creates something chaotic, he tries to create something to fix it. And the thing he creates to fix it creates more chaos until he ends up so out of control that he's barreling towards total destruction. And it takes Merlin coming back in to fix it, right? And taking his hat back. It's like, I wish there was that reset button and we could get, you know, somebody could snatch the hat for a second, because we are getting into some pretty tricky territory here. And we don't really know what happens when you... Another example, geoengineering, right? So here we are now, we're manipulating weather on a global scale. We are blasting energy into our ionosphere, literally changing the electric barrier that protects us from the sun, right? We don't know what's going to happen with that. And the people who think they know that, that paradigm that says it knows what will happen with that is the same paradigm that said your pineal gland was a vestigial organ back in the 1960s. Right? Don't worry, you can remove it, right? These were the people doing lobotomies. These are the people said your tonsils, your adenoids, and your appendix were completely vestigial organs. You don't need them. Just a few years ago, they were saying that. Then they always do these 180s where they learn what they were saying wasn't true. Or, oh, we didn't realize that. Now they want to manipulate the fabric of reality, the fabric of life, the fabric of our planet. This paradigm is, I think it's really doomed. And we don't always see that because media shows the glitz and glam and it appears very beautiful and it appears very perfect, right? And we see all day long when we tune into what the masses are saying, we see beautiful models, airbrushed abs. We see, you know, like all this like perfect glitzy car. Everything looks shiny, like it's working. But then we look outside or we take a walk in the woods. It's like, wait a sec, this thing ain't working, you know? So, you know, I think we need to get really real about where we're headed and what we want to participate in, you know?
So where do you stand in the overall scheme of things? Do you look at it more scientifically, or do you feel similarly to the tribes down in the jungle that things are very spirit based, that there is a spirit? I never hear you speaking about the spirituality behind things. You're very, I mean, probably for good reason, you might stay away from that side because you don't want maybe to be perceived as having a bias towards maybe that a way of viewing the world. But do you have any beliefs of your own about how plants and spirituality interface?
I do, yeah. I mean, for me, that's, well, you know what I think of it? I like the idea of binocular vision, right? So, you know, monocular vision is like, if I close one eye and I hold my fingers out like that, I have no depth perception. They appear to be lined up, but oh, they're not. I need two eyes open to see perspective. Now I can see, oh, now they're online, right? That makes sense? We have one eye hooked to one brain hemisphere and the other eye to the other brain hemisphere. And we know that one brain hemisphere is very logical, scientific, and mathematical. And we know the other one is more art-based and more perceptive. And I think of these things, these two paradigms, competing paradigms, as balancing halves to each other, right? So the idea that everything is spiritual in nature is a very, to me, a very right-brained concept. And the idea that everything is very mathematical in nature is a very left-brained concept. And I feel if we can use both functionally, we create a kind of binocular vision that gives us a clearer picture of reality than either one side will do. So I personally am into that synthesis idea. I believe that everything is really spiritual in nature. And I believe that science can't be working correctly if it's not validating that. But I'm also very careful because here's what I don't want. I don't want to share about this stuff and be in such a way that my work can't be heard by people who are scientific in nature. So I try to walk that really fine line, right? And I think that's important that I can talk to an astrophysicist about this and be accurate enough for them to be able to hear me. Because if I just come in with the like shaking a rattle and waving feathers around, I'm going to get nowhere with those kind of folks, right? And ultimately, those are the people who are really shaping the world much more so than those of us who are shaking rattles sometimes. I mean, we're more behind the scenes. I really do believe that as we move forward, we're going to understand more clearly, and it is filtering in now, that this is a very energetic dimension, much more than it's a physical dimension. I mean, it's only in the last, 100 years we've come to understand that solidity of an object is a perception, but not a reality, that things are actually vibrating molecules. And then we look at these molecules and they're made of atoms, and we look at these atoms and they're made of force fields. It's really weird stuff, right? And we're still just even learning how to integrate that, right? So I think as we move forward, we're going to realize that every organism is projecting a lot. It's more than just the sum of its chemicals. To me, a plant really truly does communicate with you on a biological level when you consume it, right? And what I can say scientifically to back that up now, and this has been great, more science comes out that validates the spiritual. We know now that your body is an expression of your genome, but that in particular, you have your own unique epigenome. And so your epigenome is all of the little switches that turn on your gene expression. And we know that that epigenome, how your genes are expressed, is primarily influenced by your environment. And your environment is everything from the stuff around you, the air you breathe, the sunlight you experience, the exercise you get, all the input and stimulus. Well, we know that it's really influenced by the micro RNA of plants you consume. This is powerful. So now what we see is when we consume a plant, its micro RNA interacts with our epigenome and causes us to express certain things. So what we're learning is you are what you eat, right? You're shaped by plants are like, you could almost imagine like when you eat a plant, it's like a little thumb drive of data that plugs into your data, your hard drive, your genome, and causes you to mutate and change in response to it. This is a biological communication system. And we're learning that the whole thing is actually, it's all one big communication system, right? And how we interact with things really matters. And I think what's really fascinating is we see that indigenous folks, let's say that they eat, in, let's say we find a tribe and they eat 300 different plant species in a year. Every different plant species they put in, even if it's just a small amount, influences how their genes are expressed. And their gene expression influences how they perceive and see the world. And now here we are, let's say that we're eating an average of 15 plants and they're all hyper domesticated and they're communicating their information of domestication into our system. And we have this other wonky worldview created by that, right? And so to me, it's like, even on the very scientific level, like how we perceive everything is influenced by what we choose to interact with and how we interact with it. And I think over time, we're going to understand that there's a way of walking in this world where the respect for an organism doesn't have to just come from like a spiritual place. It'll eventually come from a scientific place. Like, wow, if I consume that dandelion, it will change me fundamentally. Therefore, I respect that dandelion and I respect its race, its species, right? And I recognize that it has a valid role in this ecosystem like me, and it's another entity. And then it's not long before we end up at that place of indigenous people, like where they're at, which is like, wow, hello, friend, the dandelion, right? Like, who shares this planet with me, because we also, I don't think it's much of a stretch to understand that when we pick the dandelion, our skin oils end up in the dandelion and its genome is changed by us. Right? It's just amazing. It's deep interwoven web. To me, I think that there's a place where the spiritual paradigm and the scientific paradigm so completely intersect that they are one, and that is the greater, I guess that's the mature worldview that I know I'm personally moving towards, wanting to get to, is where I can see the world that way. Again, I think our culture wants to push us all the way one way. And I think, one of the benefits you asked earlier, what are some benefits of what we've done and learned? Part of it is that we're not trapped in only seeing the world the other way. I see that culture makes it difficult sometimes to fully live in that place. But I think literally everything we do, I really believe in that kind of law of attraction thing, not like necessarily like I use it to get mansions and Mercedes Benzes, but understanding that what I project out in the world, that there's an equal and opposite reaction, and what comes back to me is very much influenced by what I put out there. So for instance, I personally feel that as we're having this conversation and with the intention of helping the world and the people in it, that there will be benefits that will come back to me And they don't have to be, it's not necessarily like, oh, it's super spiritual. It's like somebody is going to hear this and be influenced by it in a positive way, and they're going to come back and they're going to give something back to me, right? There'll be a reaction, a response. So I think that it's a, we live in a really responsive universe, and you know, we're just so early into incorporating that into our worldview. And I think indigenous folks had put, and let's not even just indigenous folks, let's just say other civilizations, like let's say the Egyptian civilization. Clearly we look at them and we see a level of technological advancement beyond anything we can imagine, but in a different direction than we can imagine. So yes, not iPhones, but structures that we don't even understand how they were built, right? Clearly they understood something that we don't understand today. They didn't have the kinds of technology, but they had other kinds, and they were extremely developed in their worldview, very developed. We are such a young civilization compared to some of the ones that have existed, especially in the West, 200-year-old civilization. We're not even a teenagers yet. So you know, we think of ourselves as discovering all this new stuff all the time, and it's like, it's kind of childish. It's like when you're a kid and you think you're discovering something, you don't realize it's understood, well understood.
Every moment we think that we're at the peak of where we go, where human existence has ever been. Like this year, we think we are probably at the peak. I mean, you know, the new iPhone came out. I mean, it's never been this good before. But I mean, what is technology? I mean, that's what I wonder. Like, what is technology? It's just because we haven't found any buried iPhones or computers where we, like you said, tapped into something that was even better, even more efficient. I mean, is simplicity really where it's at? And every time we try to depart from simplicity and, you know, direct communion with our natural surroundings, we end up going into this long loop that brings us back to where we were to begin with. I mean, that's sort of...
Where are we trying to get to? I think it's like... I remember as a teenager, I started to ask myself a question. What is the goal of civilization? Like... Because I would look out at it and I would be like, what is this trying to get to? Like, where does it want to go? What does it want? Like, let's say that we do figure out how to eradicate death and disease and we travel the stars. Like, let's be realistic what that looks like. That looks like you're like a gray alien and part of a hive mind, right? You're not going to be like not working, right? Like, the more technology, the more work. The more technology, the more labor. What they would love to figure out is how to keep you from being able to sleep, right? So you could just work straight through and shop straight through. It never gives what it promises, which is more freedom and more ease. It actually always takes more of your freedom and takes up more of your time and work. But it promises the idea that that's all going to go away, right? So, you know, I love looking back at those old sort of black and white 50s propaganda style, early atomic theory kind of, you know, government videos where they're talking about how soon robots will make your iced tea and mow your lawn for you while you sit back and relax. And it's like, it's certainly not there right now, man. And people are putting in 80 hours a week and they can barely afford the taxes, and people are, you know, it keeps. So what is the goal here? Because when I tune into what I really want, I want to be healthy. I want to have loving relationships and community around me. I want immersive experiences in nature, right? I want to breathe fresh air, swim in clean waterfalls, drink fresh water. I want to have good quality food around people I love, feel safe and secure and not threatened in an environment that's conducive to my personal development. Sounds like we had that, right? And then this thing we have now keeps taking more and more of that away. While it consumes the whole planet in its quest to go to some undefined place with no end in sight. And the more it does it, the more people that there are, and then the more people that need to be fed. And so the more it has to consume. It just seems like this endless, like it's like a business that's going and never asked itself what its goal was. And so now we've got to ask, like, what's the goal? I think really what the goal is just to keep the people in power, and to keep their kids in power, and to keep their kids in power. And there is no goal beyond that. They just don't want to relinquish that. And it requires, there can never be a break in progress. The thing about this economy is to keep going, it needs to keep consuming land. It needs to keep consuming resources. It needs to keep buying, selling, trading, doing. That's the only way to keep growing the population. We're on this path. We delude ourselves with this idea, this new green movement, sustainability idea, sort of a little diluted in my opinion, because I sometimes make this analogy that it's like you're in a car and you're driving towards Mexico and your goal is to get to Canada, right? You're going the wrong way. So you develop technologies that slow you down. You're just going slower to Mexico. You're still not going to Canada. It doesn't matter how much you slow down, you're not go. So okay, so we're using fossil fuel. So we develop electric cars that use fossil fuel in a place you can't see to make the electricity. You're still doing the same thing. You've just slowed down how long till it runs out. It's not actually taking us towards sustainability. It's just slowing down our path of insustainability, right? So we need to 180 the car and go the other direction if we're ever going to get to our destination. We obviously have a goal destination of sustainability. I mean, mining, materials out of China, strip mining to make solar panels might look sustainable over here, but doesn't at the strip mine in China. You know what I'm saying? It's like we can paint everything green and call it green, doesn't make it green, you know? It's ironic. My bank now uses green colors. It gives the impression that they care about the environment. It's like BP has gas stations where they have like a 24-petaled lotus and the whole thing's painted green, right? These are the people that caused the greatest oil disaster in history. And they have these gas stations. Don't they almost look like an oasis? Like here you are driving through McDonald's and Burger King, and then oh, there's this, it's green, there's this like sacred geometrical lotus, and you pull in, and these people have done worse on the environment than anybody. Painting it green changes how you feel. It's a deception. And I think culture is doing that right now, but it's not, certainly not really turning itself around. It's just kind of amusing.
So, I'm going to take us off to a different world real quick. People watch this film, right? And they want to come home. And we've already talked about how we shouldn't be trying to mimic the cultures that we see in films like this. We should be trying to kind of create a hybrid sort of existence that incorporates some of their beliefs and their practices, but also keeps a lot of what we currently have going on in our life. One of the biggest questions that we get is, A, how do I get down to the Amazon? I gotta get down there. I gotta get down there. I need this. I have, it's sometimes it's like I have this condition that needs to be treated. Or if they can't get out of the Amazon, like, how do I get those herbs up here? How can I ship them out of the Amazon to get them up here? Something I've been wanting to ask you is, how can people find medicines that are in their own area of the world that are as effective as the Amazon? I think there's sort of an illusion that the Amazon, because it has so many plants, is the end all be all and the only place you can go to for healing. I mean, there's so many plants up here in the United States, there's so many plants in Europe. How do people take steps after watching this film to sort of see what they can do in the regions around them, and maybe even with the traditions that are already in the areas where they live? I mean, is there anything that they can do without having to make a large footprint on the world by having to take a flight down to the Amazon and then maybe contribute to the ecotourism that is starting to run rampant in that region?
Every plant in every organism in nature offers some medicinal value to its environment, right? It's almost like you've got to be a contributor to be here on the stage, right? On planet Earth, you've got to offer something back. Now, one of the things about the domestication of plants is that when we domesticate plants, what we're trying to do is take a wild plant and make it more palatable, make it have more calories, make it grow bigger and fatter, right? So, one of my favorite examples, I think is really powerful actually, is wild lettuces. Now, I have wild lettuces that grow in my yard, and the wild lettuce is a mildly narcotic plant. You wouldn't recognize this plant as the lettuce in your garden unless you might, if you ever let lettuce grow all the way out to seed, you can kind of sort of see it. But most of us listening have see wild lettuces all the time, don't recognize it. Now, wild lettuce is sold in the back of High Times magazine as a marijuana substitute. So they literally grind it up and people smoke it because you can get a slight high from it. And in the early part of American culture, we were using it as an opium substitute. So you might go in with an opiate addiction and an herbalist or doctor at the time, actually, it was part of the US Pharmacopoeia, doctor would put you on wild lettuce as a substitute for opium. And it was used the same way in Europe and even all the way back to, we see Egyptian records saying, 6,000 years ago, saying that, wild lettuce is a narcotic. Now, when we breed lettuce for the store, the kind that we use as food, we, because the part that's the drug tastes bitter in our mouth, we've bred it not to be there anymore. So we had this plant that we used to eat that it gave us a medicinal benefit that actually kept us healthier, right? But now that's gone.
And we've done that with all of our plants. So we have all these plants in the supermarket that we've bred to taste better. And in so doing so, we've bred the bitter tasting alkaloids, which are the drugs, out of the plants. So, you know, there's this famous quote, let food be thy medicine and medicine be thy food. Now, when that was written, there was less domestication and people ate more wild and bitter plants. So what happens now is you hear that and you go, that makes sense. I'm going to let food be my medicine. And then you realize that the foods you eat don't really have any medicine left. Right. So then what do? You're like, oh, man, there's no medicine in this food. You end up with a physiological, just like you can end up with a vitamin A deficiency or a vitamin C deficiency or a, let's say, an iodine deficiency. You end up with a drug alkaloid deficiency. Now, this is great for the pharmaceutical companies who take plants, extract out their alkaloids, change them slightly, and then patent them, and then sell them back to you. So you eat this diet lacking medicine, and then you buy back pharmaceutical medicines, which are too strong and actually cause side effects because they're not contained within the full matrix or suite of other nutrients that would have been in the wild plant. That's a rant. Herbalism, the whole idea of herbalism, is based off wild plants. So herbalism is never like, oh, this is a ground up, you know, broccoli tea. Broccoli is a domesticated plant. It lacks its phytochemistry that was natural to its wild predecessor, the Brassica oleracea. And so we need wild plants. So herbalism, when we look at herbalism, we're talking about wild plants. Now, of course, the Amazon is incredibly diverse. There's a lot of diversity there, right? So there's a lot of medicine there. But we tend to think anything exotic is better. We always do that, right? So what happens when you go over to Bangkok and you see on the streets, you know, you think, wow, this is such great. I'm going to buy a silk pair of pants and these cool like wooden – and they're selling knockoff diesel jeans. Why? Because to them, that's exotic. And so it's better, right? And we're doing the same thing. We don't realize that all around us, we're literally walking through a sea of herbal medicine that would be healing us on a profound level. And instead, we then purchase it from really far away and try to bring it here. That's a mistake, I think, because usually the medicines that people need are the medicines that are near them because those medicines are functioning in the environment where they're living. So it makes a lot of sense. Like, of course, what you need are medicines that attune you to the physiological things that go wrong in your particular environment, right? Okay, so how do we get involved with that? Here's a couple ways. One way would be to take stock of what you have for issues, physiological issues, like things that you'd like to heal, and start looking for herbs that work on that and figure out which herbs actually grow near you. You're going to find a lot of them do. Another way to do that would be to find somebody who does plant walks in your area, particularly looking at different herbal societies in your area. Just get on the internet, start searching your area and herb walks or wild plant walks and go out with people who are knowledgeable in that way. Obviously, like YouTube is just this endless, I mean, just start looking up wild. What you find pretty fast is that there's not a plant you can find growing wild that isn't medicinal. Even if it's poisonous, it's usually used in very tiny doses medicinally. An example would be foxglove. I mean, that will stop your heart, but in very small doses becomes a cardiac medicine. So really what's going on here is all the medicines we need grow all around us. What is really valuable is to learn a little bit about how to use them. And the key is, and you know, and we see this in your film, the production of teas and extracts in water. I mean, that is one of the best ways to get herbs into you. So here's what we're doing. We're eating a diet that's really devoid in the kind of medicines that we need. So we need to take supplemental herbal plants, right? And we need to either blend those and strain them with water, or we need to put them in hot water and let them steep, or we need to certain things boil in water to make extractions. And occasionally we benefit from just soaking things in alcohol for a couple of weeks, straining that and taking droppers of that as a tincture. Those techniques are really easy to learn at home. So those would be infusion, that's a tea, decoction, that's a boiling, maceration, that'd be like a blending, or tincturing, that's doing an alcohol. Learn those four things. Look them up on YouTube. I've got plenty of stuff on the internet showing how to do that. Then you can start to go on your herb walks and learn your different plants and find the ones that will work for you. I keep bringing up dandelion because to me it's like a totem. It's totemic for me. And it's everywhere, right? Dandelion taught me something. It taught me that it will end up in your garden, but it doesn't need your garden to grow. Lettuce, on the other hand, like a cultivated lettuce or a cultivated broccoli, it needs your garden and it can't escape. Right? You notice this? you don't worry that broccoli doesn't take over your lawn and then start growing in your, you don't have your neighbor coming over knocking on the door. Hey, your broccoli's taking over my lawn, buddy. I wish, right? Wouldn't that be awesome? It can't. It's too weak genetically because it's a mutant that we've created in domestication. The dandelion's this wild plant. It will take over anything, right? Just grow anywhere. It's so rugged. The aerial part of the plant, everything that grows above the ground, that all works on your kidneys. It's diuretic and it causes you to urinate more, but it feeds back in the things that are important that we lose through urinating a lot. So a typical diuretic will make you lose potassium, say, like if you took a diuretic pill from a doctor. The problem is you're peeing out all this fluid. Like say somebody's holding onto a lot of fluid. They've got swollen ankles. The diuretic will help get rid of that fluid, but they lose precious minerals. Dandelion makes you get rid of that fluid, but gives you back the minerals you're losing, right? Amazing. And its name in French is pissenlit, which means to piss the bed. And it's just a reference to how it makes you urinate. But then if we eat the part that grows under the ground, the root, it causes us to produce more bile in our liver and fill our gallbladder. It causes us to squeeze more bile out into our digestive system. And it cleans and protects the liver all at the same time. So the lowly dandelion that everyone's waging war against and spraying Roundup on and trying to get rid of is this medicine that cleans the kidneys and blood and cleans the liver and improves digestion. And here it is all around us, and almost every American could use a cleaner bloodstream and better functioning liver, right? And here it is all around us. Now, we could import some amazing liver cleansing herbs from the Amazon, but we don't need to, right? And we live in this environment. And remember I was talking before, epigenetic changes that happen to your genome when you consume something, it dials you to your environment. So when we consume stuff from the Amazon, it's great. But it is dialing us to the Amazon, and here we are up in the temperate regions of North America. Maybe our plants here would be better. So that was just dandelion. We could do this with plant after plant after plant, and so many of them are in your yard. You don't need to consume tons of this stuff. You don't have to go crazy with it. You just start bringing it in. So I like to tell people, learn one plant. You just learned one today, dandelion. You learn one plant, you learn how to work with it. You don't necessarily have to harvest it yourself. You can buy it. And I often do that, right? Go through an outlet, purchase it in bulk, start making your own teas and tinctures and playing with that. What happens is we're in a situation where we have to consume these mega doses of certain medicines because of diseases that we've developed culturally. What makes more sense is to eat a suite of wild plants in your year that have all so many different little medicines in them that they keep your body adapting and reacting so that you stay constantly homeodynamic, like balanced, rather than, oh, I let a disease develop, now I have to treat it. That's actually, that's when we've gone a little further than we needed to. So indigenous people were kept really healthy because they ate so many plants that they got so many plant drugs in them that it was like they were taking cocktails of preventative medicines. They look at us, we're like white bread, right? We're like, there's nothing left but carbs. We've got nothing in our diet that's given us medicine. And unfortunately, even the really good stuff from our farmer's market is domesticated. So we got to bring herbalism in. The stuff around us, I'm telling you, it's really where it's at. And there is a level of confidence that comes from consuming wild plants. And, you know, it's not just these bitter wild herbs. It's things like your wild blueberries or wild raspberries around you, providing you with the phenols necessary. You know, ripening in the summertime when you're being exposed to maximum UV, they give you maximum antioxidants to protect your skin, as an example. So as the year goes on, the things that are coming up dial you to the specific needs of that time. So there's this magical thing. You know, when I first got into herbalism, I consumed a lot of Amazonian herbs. Now, almost none, because what I find is, here's another example. There's this herb out of the Amazon called chanca piedra, right? Stone breaker, it means. It's really good for people breaking up kidney stones. Awesome. People need that. But we have a plant right here called jopai weed that grows here that does that same thing. So we don't have to bring it and exploit the Amazon. We have herbs here that people are just mowing down indiscriminately. So I agree. There's a tendency to love the exotic. And there are specific instances where it really makes sense. And there are things like, for instance, ayahuasca. We don't really have a substitute for that here in the Northeast. And that's a powerful decoction of a couple of plants or sometimes multiple dozens of plants. Very, very valuable for people for certain circumstances. I think there are those exceptions. But, you know, for our day-to-day needs, it's awesome if you can find your medicine. medicine and calories in your local environment.
The miracle really is your connection with your local, with your natural environment, period. And understanding, you know, the power that plants have everywhere. So,
and you know, I want to point out, you know, I loved in your film, there's this idea of the dieta, you know, that we see in South America, where you basically, in that shamanic tradition, as well as I understand it, you reduce down external influence as much as possible so that this one entity, this one organism, can share with you as much as possible. Now, here, let's make a metaphor here. If I meet somebody, let's say my partner, Alexandra, what she provides for me in my life, what's healing about my relationship with her, has nothing to do with chemicals in her body. It has to do with the relationship with her as a holistic being, right? So if I bring a plant into my life, it's not necessarily, our paradigm says it's because this chemical in here, this particular alkaloid affects this pathway of this in your body and blah, blah, blah. When I think the real Amazonian shamanic understanding would be, no, that's too myopic. It's the entity itself in its complete holism brings a certain force or energy into your life that balances something in you. So in the same way, my partner, it's her as a person balances influences in me and vice versa. So it's a relationship, right? Another way to say it would be, you when you see a painting, right, when we look at the Sistine Chapel ceiling, we wouldn't say that the effect of that is based on a specific color of paint or a specific ratio of this paint to this paint to this paint. It's the holistic overall impression that's left from seeing the thing in its wholeness, right? Now, if I go into the Sistine Chapel, but I've got headphones blasting and I'm watching a DVD or watching a video on my phone and I've got kids pulling at me, I'm going to have a hard time taking that in and being influenced by it. Similarly, if we're taking an herb, but we're also blasting ourselves out with all kinds of other influences, it's hard to actually relate with it. So in the dieta, and what we saw in your film was people removing so many external influences that it was like they took off the headphones, they set down the phone, the kids aren't pulling at them, and it's just them and this plant and like some water, right? You're not even getting like the salt, like the, you know, no stimulation. So that you go into one-on-one relationship, like a blind date that goes on for weeks, right? To where you, this relationship heals you. We have a difficult time here because our paradigm says it's this chemical or that chemical, and it's like saying it's this color or that color in a painting, and there's more to it than that. But unfortunately, that's what we're dealing with. But I think that just getting the herb ground up in a capsule and just shooting it back in the morning, like, it's not as effective as learning. So to me, what I love about foraging, right? You go out and you see this plant in its wholeness. You see what it looks like, what it grows, what kind of environment it grows in, what other things it grows around. You touch it, you interact with it. There's a relationship that's formed. And then what's cool is, let's say you're harvesting a plant that's really only useful to you in the autumn. But you see that plant in the spring and the summer. You know it's not useful yet, but you see it and you're like, hey, I know you. Like, we connect. Like, you're one of my allies. We're allies. I appreciate you. You appreciate me. We work together, and I'm an advocate for you and you're an advocate for me. And you see it all around you. It's sort of like there's this connectedness to your environment. Like, I have friends here, right? That's what's really powerful. So, and I think then when we consume that herb, we're consuming more than just the chemicals. We're consuming all that information that we've attained through relationship with the plant. This is something I don't think we can effectively, you know, we walk into a GNC and we grab some horny goat weed off the shelf. I mean, there's an effect at the chemical level, but that's not the effect that a lot of us are looking for. So you're talking about going deeper, and going deeper is all about meeting the plants. I think really about meeting the plants, and the diet is one way to do that. Foraging is another way to do that.
Yeah, one thing I think people were really kind of surprised by was when they got down to the healing center we had created, they thought they were going to be able to have their book with them, and they had all these books, and they were going to, you know, have these, like, you know, spiritual, like, you know, songs playing in their headphones during this. I got this. I don't want to be alone, but I got my stuff. All that stuff got taken away. They're like, wait, I can't even have my notebook. I can't even have a pen. I mean, how am I going to create a diary? Don't I need this sort of experience? And they're like, no, you don't. You're going to be there in your bed. We'll give you changes of clothes, and the rest is going to be you sitting there working with the plants. That's it.
And there was a woman in the film who described, and I was really actually moved by what she was saying. She was describing sort of how, you know, in our culture, we can, there's so much stimulation, we can avoid coming face to face with certain issues, right? The disease is not the lack of that plant, right? The disease is something we impose upon ourselves from a psychological, spiritual avoidance of something going on for us, right? And we avoid it and we avoid it, and it gets worse and worse, and we know it, we can sense it. But until we stop and come face to face with ourselves, it's really easy to keep running from it, and it's easy to medicate, right? So we all have, we don't even want to admit to ourselves sometimes how serious something is. We don't want to feel it. We don't want to look at it. And there's no shortage of ways to avoid it. And what I loved about what you guys did there was like you said, you know, people had no choice. You come face to face. You sit alone in the quiet for 24 hours. You start facing things that you've avoided for years that have been right on the tip of your mind. But every time they get close, you stimulate. I know I'm certainly a victim of this and a perpetrator of it, as is everybody, right? And we don't have the institutions here. For instance, we don't have the institution of the shaman in our culture, right? So there are folks, or let's say like in an Asiatic culture where there was a monastic, like if we had a Zen culture, and there was an outlet, like you could go join this place. If you wanted to be the person who simply sits and meditates and lives a simple life, there's a place for that. We are equivalent to the shaman. Let's say this is the medical doctor, right? That person, by the time they're even ready to practice, is so overstimulated with information, so deep into debt, so overworked, they're not getting to sit with anything, right? The shaman actually goes through the process on themselves, through themselves, and they go through multiple heavy death-like experiences, coming face to face with what they really are. We don't have that equivalent function in our society. So I think one of the reasons people crave this kind of thing like you're talking about to go do an experience like that is because it's hard to find that here. Where do you find quiet? And the thing is that the technology is reaching deeper and deeper, right? So we're about to make a transition. So I'd say in the next 6 months, we're going to see the Google Glass filter in. And right on the tails of that are all of the smartphone watches. So people are about to make a shift from carrying. This is a big deal. We're going to shift from carrying to a more cyborg-like interface, right? So people are going to become cyborg. It's going to be that much more difficult to stop the input of all this data that allows us for keeps us from actually stopping and feeling what's actually going on for us. So, I mean, you know, how much of the healing that people experienced in your film was about the plant and how much was about them getting real about things emotionally going on in their life, memories that they have, traumatic experiences that they never released from their nervous system, on and on and on. There's all this healing that can happen. I don't think it's necessarily that we need to put anything in sometimes, so we need to stop for a second. But that's one of the hardest things, you know, and I say that from experience, you know.
I think it's really funny. I sometimes get in this kind of holier-than-thou sort of a, you know, mentality where I'm like, yeah, you know, why can't you guys all get it? But even like I've done it, you know, I feel like I've reached these places where I'm like, wow, I'm really doing the work and I'm getting somewhere. But in, you know, invariably I go back into, you know, the lifestyle of the people that I surround myself with. So I'm living here, I'm in Berkeley, California, which is a very spiritual place, but still, you, as soon as you get back into your community in this, and especially here in the States, you forget about a lot of that stuff and you start building up these distractions and then creating the wounding again and not having a way to get rid of it. So it's amazing to me how we're so averse or blind to doing the work it takes to get fully healthy, whether you're using plants or just, like you said, reducing the external stimuli and kind of understanding what's going on in the ticker tape of your thought patterns, you know?
So how do we, based on this idea of being the new Aboriginal, right, how do we, and this is one of my biggest challenges has been, so here's something real personal for me, is I've been over the years so frustrated with the condition of the world. And there's this thing that's happening for me as I get into the second part of my life of deciding that it's time to accept it, right? Accept that there's nuclear energy, accept that they're geoengineering the world, accept that organism, I just, because the resistance to it and the fighting of it
ultimately creates more of that wounding that you're talking about. How do I accept then that my, for instance, okay, it's a polluted environment, right? I just got to accept that. Or, okay, Berkeley, like here it is. I'm in the thick of this, in some of the most intense human intellectualization that's ever existed, right? There you are in the heart of that. It's a very stimulating place. How do you become the new Aboriginal there, right? How do we let the influence of the iPhone and Wi-Fi be part of our spiritual development, right? How do we let our relationship to Fukushima be part of our maturing and spiritual development rather than just fighting it, right? Because there's the desire to just push it away and be in denial, right? I guess it's like the grief process, right? It's like first we kind of want to deny it, right? And then we're angry about it. Right. And then we want to like figure out, well, if I do this and I do that, maybe I can get it to go away and like bargain it away. Right. And then that doesn't work. And then we get into like, it's depressing. Right. And we go through this and then finally like accepting it and saying, okay, I want to become a mature neo-Aboriginal human being through in this world. Cause I literally, we can all make change, but I can't change all this stuff overnight. So I let, you know, how do I release the wounds and not have to, I guess, how do I do it without having to live in sensory deprivation? Because I can go do that for a period of time, right? I could go to a 10-day Vipassana, I could go to 30 days in the Amazon, but eventually I got to come back here. That's where the real work begins, right? That's actually the real, I mean, it's a lot of work to go into sensory deprivation, but it's just as much work living here. And ultimately that's what we have to do. We are integrated into it. So how do we be healthy here? And nobody knows because this stuff's all really new. Right. I remember there was no iPhone 10 years ago. This is new. And so we're learning, we're making it up as we go. And we have to be pretty adaptable to do it.
Yeah, man, I think that might be the way to close out here. I think that's true. I mean, I feel like all this information, it's so easy to kind of get wrapped up in how much possibility there is and also how much sadness and destruction there is. But I guess, like you said, the true Aboriginal can sort of see both, not react to either, and just take the path that makes the most sense.
Right? Yeah. We just walk that middle way as best as we can. And
hey, I mean, as much as it's sort of frustrating from time to time, it's also really exciting. It's a pretty mm-hmm. exciting time to be alive.
Yeah, I'd say it's a wind tunnel of excitement. Totally.
Thank you, my friend.
Yeah, really happy to be here. Thanks so much, man.